science journalism conveys reporting about science to the public. It's a big responsibility. Every word matters. We're learning how to do it well this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Newsrooms eliminated nearly one out of four staff positions between 2008 and 2017. That's Pew Research. Wasn't that long ago, media observers were concerned that science desks were drying up too. Science reporting was on a path to extinction, but that didn't come to pass. There are news outlets and podcasts where we see science journalism thriving alive and well. So what do you think have been the most interesting science stories in the news lately? Do you follow science news? What interests you about it? We're at 800-642-1234. Joe Palca has been a science correspondent for NPR since 1992. He's the host of the series Joe's Big Idea. He founded a science communication collective. He's in Madison for the annual meeting and student research conference of Sigma Xi, the Scientific Research Honor Society. Joe Palca, welcome to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you. To be here.
Well, Morning Edition is celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. Science has changed a ton since that first show aired in 1979. You were charged with like condensing all those milestones into like a 4-minute conversation with host Rachel Martin on Morning Edition. And I'm listening to that and thinking, okay, Joe Palca is a really good sport here because he is leaving so much of the cutting room floor about these scientific discoveries. How, you know, before we explore these discoveries, do you struggle with what level of detail to put in and leave out in your reporting?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we actually had 7 minutes, so I was in clover for that one. well, we can get into a long discussion about what makes science news, because I have this theory about, you know, how science proceeds by increment and news proceeds by breakthrough, or, you know, proceeds by huge jumps, or it's always something new each day. In science, it's like, oh, this tiny little change. So you do really have to have a different kind of time frame, but you also have to be careful because you can't run into the newsroom, as I say, and, oh, look, there was a small earthquake and only a few people were injured. You know, they don't want that story. They want today, it happened, it's important. And when you have a science story and you say, well, this might be important in 10 years or 20 years, I'm not really sure, you sort of have to balance the truth with the newsiness. And so the 10 years, I mean, goodness gracious, there was that. I mean, it's laughable. It's laughable. I mean, 7 minutes to talk about 40 years of science is hysterical. Oh, never mind science. We want technology. We want environment. We want health and medicine. Can you do it?
Yeah, can you just bundle that out, Joe Palca?
The answer is, of course, because there's no – people say, how long is that story? And I say, well, how long do you want it to be? I mean, you know, I could go on – I could write a book about the last 40 years of science, or I could do it in 7 minutes. Up to you. It's just – obviously, there'll be a lot left out. And I'm not, you know, people get, you know, oh, you dumb it down. Okay, let's think about this for a second. I'm really going to explain astrophysics in 7 minutes to anybody? How is that going to be anything like a physics course? Of course, it's not. It's simplifying it. It's leaving a ton out. But it's trying to get the essence of what we're talking about and explain it to people who don't necessarily know what you're talking about. And I guess if there's anything that I've been proud of in my career, it's the fact that people who don't know science say to me, gee, I really enjoyed that story and I sort of understood what you were talking about. But even more, and this is kind of bad and good, but even more, I don't get scientists yelling at me saying, how did you distort my science so much? Mm. And so I'm somehow walking that fine line between accuracy and simplification, and it's hard. I mean, it's really hard. I have a PhD in physiological psychology. I earned it over 30 years ago, more than 30 years ago. Anything I learned in graduate school has been debunked by now. I mean, it's all changed. And so the only thing I've learned is the process of how you ask questions about science and how you explore the world about science. And, you know, I try and learn it and explain it. That's all.
What I love about your storytelling is that you put a face on these scientists who are working in their labs every day. They're completely behind the scenes in our world, and they are working and working, and maybe that discovery will come by the time their grant is finished, or by the time their lifetime is finished, maybe not.
Yep.
And we feel through your stories, you know, one step of their lives, a footprint.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That's all. That's the best I can hope for, because I do feel that there's this tendency to make scientists experts. And so you stop talking to the person and you start talking to this expert. And a lot of times scientists will say to me, it's not about me, it's about my science. And I will say to them, no, it's about you. This isn't a course, you know. Mm-hmm. This is a radio story, and I'm in the story and you're in the story. And let's try to understand that. I mean, it doesn't have to be all about you and all about me, but I worked with this woman, Maddie Sofia, who's now the host of NPR's new science podcast, Shortwave. Okay, I shout out to Shortwave. Now they owe me. And she said she grew up in a small town in Ohio, and she said that a lot of people in her town never met a scientist. And so I don't know if that's true of most of NPR's audience, but it makes me realize you have to let the world know that these are people. And they're people who've got some specialized knowledge in many cases, but they're just people, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important part of the scientific process to share with people.
We are here with Joe Palca. He is a science correspondent for NPR. He's visiting Wisconsin this week. You can join in. What do you think are some of the biggest scientific discoveries in your lifetime? What has dramatically changed how you live or how you view the world? Join in the conversation at any point, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Tim now, joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Tim.
Hello.
What's
How are
on,
you?
Good. What's on your mind about science?
CRISPR. I think it's amazing. The potential to end human disease, I don't know much about it, but I think it's just crazy that they can splice DNA and add DNA and take out DNA. I think it's amazing. It's crazy.
I'm with you. I think it's a stunning tool. But I'm curious to think, I mean, what would you want to do with it?
Just make people better.
Okay, so here's one. I was born cross-eyed, right? Well, I guess that doesn't really, there's some people who are worried about, you know, tinkering with genes for some sort of nefarious purposes, you know, to create enhanced people. What do you think about that?
No, I disagree. To make a superhuman? No, I disagree. But to end potential suffering like rheumatoid arthritis or immuno diseases, anything like that, we've been doing this for centuries. It's not different. It's just more advanced.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. And the other interesting thing about CRISPR is it really points to the fact that...
And this is gene editing.
This is this gene editing tool that was actually... It's funny. It came from bacteria that were using this tool to fight off viral infections. And we sort of usurped the technology from nature and tinkered with it and managed to use it as a gene editing tool. Still, the question is, what genes do you want to edit? And there's a lot of basic research that goes on before you can even use CRISPR.
We're exploring the world of science, how to cover it, with NPR science correspondent Joe Palca as our guide. Are you a scientist? Do you think journalists are science literate? Or do you find yourself frustrated by the way the media translates science topics? Join in with your thoughts, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a moment with Joe Palca here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about science journalism here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. How do we get our arms around the big concepts, the scientific jargon, the discoveries that could potentially one day make a dramatic difference in a corner of our planet, but they are really, really hard to see and not very tangible? So this is the bread and butter of NPR science correspondent Joe Palca, who stays with us for the hour. His work helps keep us curious about how the world works. You can join in, 800-642-1234. And Joe Pelka stays with us as we explore his craft. Let's bring in Pam now, joining us from Richland Center. Hello. Hi, Pam.
Hi. You were asking what was impactful, and I really think all of what we're learning about the brain is amazing. I mean, it's an amazing piece of machinery, but all that we know about brain health, and we're discovering how important sleep is, how important, you know, diet is, how important, like, gut bacteria might be influencing the brain, how, like, a lot of it is still in the early stages, but just really looking into the brain.
Oh, Pam, we just lost you there, I think. But, you know, we were talking just yesterday about longevity and how that the brain is just the one mystery that is going to really be hard to unlock because there's a whole lot going on up there.
Not in mine. They should just study me. It's all pretty simple. When's my next food? That's all. I think, you know, it's really it just cracks me up. It is astounding how little we know about the brain. There are, as you were saying, there have been amazing discoveries and there are amazing things that we have learned, but it just tells you how much more there is to go. When I started my scientific career, it really began in 1986. I went to work for an international journal called Nature, and we did a conference in Boston called How the Brain Works, and I thought, this is hilarious. This was 1986. We're explaining how the brain works. Good luck with that. And now it's, 2019, How the Brain Works? Yeah, I'm sure. We know a tiny bit more. That's okay. I mean, everything we learn is going to be interesting, and it's all going to form a better understanding. But
Well, it's like every time we learn something new, we unlock a whole bunch of more questions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And think about it. I mean, how would you study yourself? I mean, it's a philosophical question as much as anything. I mean, what people are – well, I think people, philosophers knew this all the time. But, you know, what the world is to us is what our brains tell us it is. It's not what – our eyes are telling us, our ears are telling us. They're just transducing. They're taking physical stimuli and turn them into nerve impulses. It's this thing inside of our skulls that's creating the reality that we see around us. Holy smokes, how did you know how to do that? I mean, as somebody said, it's a good thing I don't have actual control of how my brain works because I wouldn't know what to do.
Well, let's go to Don now, joining us from Finlayson, Minnesota. Is that right, Don?
Yes.
All right. What's on your mind?
Well, you know, like I was telling the guy who answered the phones, people do not remember some of the great discoveries of the 20th century we take for granted. The one that always comes to mind is antibiotics, and we take them for granted. And, you know, my dad was a medic in World War II in the Pacific, and when they brought penicillin on board, it was a miracle.
Yeah, yeah. There, that one is astonishing. And again, the difficult thing is, as I'm sure you know, is that the drugs like penicillin have been around for so long now that A, people think they're always been there, but B, the bacteria are figuring out ways to defeat them.
Yeah, of course.
And
like I said, we take them for granted.
Exactly. And one of the things is that people say, oh, I want an antibiotic. And sometimes doctors say, well, look, you have a viral infection. An antibiotic's not going to do anything for you. And they say, yes, I know, but I want one anyway. Well, that's why we have problems, I think, is that people are taking when they ought not to. But yes, I completely agree. It's one of those things that, you know, it kind of goes by and it becomes part of the tapestry. And you have to stop and think once in a while, wow, this didn't used to be the case. This used to be a life-ending illness, and now I'm dancing down the street a week later.
We are catching up with Joe Pelka, a science correspondent for NPR, who's visiting Wisconsin this week. What are your questions about the media's coverage of science issues? Join in, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in John now, joining us from Appleton. Hi, John.
Hey, good morning, everybody, and thank you for all you do. So since February, we've been getting the New York Times. I want to preface this by saying I once had a chance to talk with a local meteorologist. And I asked him, hey, would all the major TV metropolitan meteorologists ever come on the do one show on climate change. And it goes time. It goes to your other point before about how much we educate folks on science. But the real reason I called was about climate change. So in the New York Times this past week, the article called "How Scientists Got It So Wrong," and they talk about the public perception of climate change. So I'm going to read you some statistics. I know it's difficult for the radio, but
yeah, very, very quickly here, because I think that we do want to talk here about climate change. The media started reporting on climate change in the early 80s. Morning Edition was talking about it as far back as 1982. You know, as our understanding of a change in climate has increased, Joe Pelka, how have you seen the public discussion about a change?
Well, it's amazing to me that there's still a debate about whether this is a real phenomenon or not. I mean, it's not a debate in the scientific community. It's a debate in some public arenas. I think it's very hard to wrap your head around climate change because it's not happening in a way that you can actually go outside and see in a day or a week. And I think those large phenomena that happen slowly are the hardest to sort of conceptualize. And again, we were talking about the brain. Our brain isn't made for that kind of a problem. And it's not immediate. It's not fight or flight. It's not a threat that is tangible. And so I think it becomes more abstract. And you do have to put your faith in a bunch of people who you don't know who've said, look, we've measured temperatures in, you know, around the globe. Well, what did you do? Stick a thermometer in the earth? I mean, it turns out to be a complicated question of how you measure the earth temperature. So I think people are just it's fallen into a funny kind of political arena, which not that many science stories have that happen to them. I mean, people don't argue mm-hmm. about whether a cloned sheep was cloned. It's not a Democratic clone or Republican clone. It was a clone. And suddenly this one has become politicized.
And when media outlets said, yes, climate change is real, we are covering it as real, mm-hmm. did that change science reporting at all?
You know, that's a great question. It didn't change science reporting because, as I said, the debate was never within the science community. I mean, at some point it was. I mean, there were people who were skeptics at first, but the evidence became more and more convincing. And, you know, there could always be somebody who says, I don't agree. But if you're looking to understand the consensus of a community, you come away with one point of view. The change was where it became people were asked about their opinion who knew nothing about climate change. I mean, I remember the governor of Florida at one point he was a skeptic, and he had a bunch of top scientists who said, I'll come in and talk to you. And he listened to them for half an hour and said, I don't believe you. Well, I mean, where does his knowledge come from that he can say, I don't believe you? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like saying, what, you think that they're making this up? Or you just don't like what they're saying, but I don't see how you can say. So it became a political story, and that's where it changed. I mean, as I said, most of the science stories that I do don't become so political. Some of them do, obviously.
How is the health of the science desk as you see it at media outlets around the country? Because, you know, newsrooms are shrinking,
yeah.
And media outlets are going away, but there's also a surge in podcasts and other media.
Yeah, I think you hit it. I don't know what's happening to our profession. I got into media, you know, journalism 30, 40 years ago, 35 years ago, whatever, and it's definitely changed. But I'm not so worried because there's still a lot of really talented young science writers who are getting into the field, so that's encouraging. And somebody will figure out the economic model that will allow it to go forward. I mean, there are Voxes and BuzzFeeds, and they have terrific science reporters working there. It's not like, you know, the New York Times or NPR, anybody has a lock on all the good science reporting. There's some outstanding outlets that we never heard of. So, yeah, it's what society values. Whether it's the hard thing is, you know, do you want to pay for it? Everybody likes it. I mean, I don't think anybody doesn't like it. It's just that who wants to pay for it? NPR's model is crazy. Hey, you can listen for free if you want, but please give us money. How does that work? But it works.
NPR science correspondent Joe Pelka is with us as we revisit memorable moments from his reporting. We talk about science. Do you follow science news? What interests you about it? Where do you get your news about science? Do you read journals? How do you keep abreast of scientific developments? Join in 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Coming up, we're going to learn about a Milwaukee County retired math professor whose love of solving elegant equations was passed on to so many scientists around the country who are just realizing their special bond they share. Joe Pelka will share this story with us right after this news update here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A note on coverage here. The public hearings of the House impeachment inquiry into President Trump continue this morning. You can hear live coverage on WPR. We're carrying it on our NPR News and Classical Music Network starting at 8. Former Ukraine Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch is set to testify. Live coverage of the hearings beginning in 25 minutes on the NPR News and Classical Music Network, online at WPR.org. Right now, we're talking with a longtime NPR science correspondent, Joe Pelka. We're delving into some of his recent storytelling. We're exploring the intersection of news media and the science world, and then what the politicization of facts means for science and journalism today. What do you want to ask Joe Pelka about reporting on science? How do you think the news media do at covering climate change? Join in 800-642-1234. So, Joe, another story you did this year looked at this retired math professor named George Berzeny, who is originally from Hungary, now lives in Milwaukee. Berzeny has mentored thousands of students through the years. He was nominated for a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Mathematics Association of America. Here he is.
One of the things I believe that made these students look up to me, that every time I would meet any of them, I would handle them as equals. In spite of their youth, I consider them mathematically superbly mature and treat them in such fashion. I really admire them.
Tell us about him.
Yeah, this it's such a strange story. But I was at actually the memorial service of a good friend of my family's, and the widow, who's also my good friend, came running over to me and said, you have to talk to my neighbor. And the neighbor was a geneticist at Massachusetts General Hospital who told me this amazing story, which I tell part of in this radio piece you played, about this guy, this Hungarian mathematician who came to America and started tutoring high school students and mentoring, really, because he wasn't teaching them how to solve equations. I mean, that's part of it, but he was challenging them with math problems. And, you know, it's for me, I have a hard time covering math because I don't really – I mean, after you do alphabet, algebra, it's complicated. But, you know, Rubik's Cube is an example of a math problem. And I don't think of it that way, but mathematicians do. And so this Vamsi Mutha happens to be the guy's name who lived in Cambridge said, you should meet this George Berzeny. And he was the one that nominated George for the Lifetime Achievement Award. And it just, as I started peeling back and finding, oh, you knew this person. Oh, you knew that person. Oh, I mean, unbelievable the number of people. Nobody's ever heard of him. So on a... Again, that's because NPR is such a great place and people will let you pursue things that you say, you know, this is great. You have to let me do this. I flew to Milwaukee and we spent a day just with him reminiscing. You can hear he's got a bazillion stories. And so I talked to him and I talked to some of the famous people he interviewed. But really, when he was talking to me, he told me the story of what someone he thought was his smartest student. Mm-hmm. Who didn't become a famous mathematician. So I tracked that guy down. And
what was his life like?
Well, he had actually – so the story was he went off to college and he didn't really do that well in college because he didn't have the support network, and he kind of, you know, he got into playing ping pong. I don't know. He really wasn't into it. And so he kind of his horizons were not as broad as some of them. And he wound up staying in Beaumont, Texas as a teacher. And he wanted to say to George, which I guess they had stayed in touch, you know, you moved me, and I've dedicated my life to doing what you've done, which is encouraging young students. So in a way, he didn't have the kind of the success that would put him on National Public Radio as the story, you know, story. But he did something really fundamentally important, and it just tied the whole story together so nicely. Of this George who tutored or mentored really, really exceptional human talents, and then also exceptional human beings. Who
and I love the aha moment in the story as scientists around the country start like realizing they have this
guy in common. They didn't know it. I mean, that was, I mean, again, the story was just, oh, did you, it's a funny, it's 8 minutes or longer, even 10
it's
minute
like 10
piece.
Minutes, yeah.
But you don't even hear from George until 3 minutes into the piece, because usually when you tell a story about somebody, that's the person you hear from. But there was so much setup to get to him.
So Wisconsinites might want to know, how did Berzenni get from Texas to Wisconsin, to Milwaukee? Do we know?
Yeah, he went to a university after he was at Beaumont. He went to University of Indiana. And then I asked him why he moved to Milwaukee, and one of his children was working there. And they were ready to retire, and so they decided to retire to Milwaukee,
yeah. Well, let's bring in Joey now, joining us from West B. Hi, Joey.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I'm just curious about if any perceived bias by the media when it comes to things like climate change. Currently, if you went on, say, NASA's website, you would see that within the past 5 years, Antarctic sea ice extent is at the largest in history, recorded history. And that currently ice loss is much less than the ice gains. And this is on NASA's website. If you go to the USGS, you'll see that fires worldwide are down. If you go to, I forget which government service it is, but also flooding. There's been no appreciable change in flooding in the past century. So these are all accredited published articles posted by the U.S. government. And I'm wondering why there's no coverage of those articles.
Well, I don't know that there's been no coverage, but the problem with any individual data point is that it is not enough to paint a complete picture. So if I may have visited the websites you're talking about. I may not. I don't remember. But if sea ice is increasing in the Arctic or the Antarctic, as you said, there's not a lot of the specific point is only important if it's taken in a global context. And so if I have to say, well, this has happened here in the last 5 years, I have to look at, if I'm going to try and explain what's happening at the whole planet, I have to talk about all the other things that are happening at the same time. And so it's very difficult to focus on one thing and try to explain that, because I have this chart I show about things that cause cancer and things that prevent cancer. And it has coffee and butter and meat. And you can find that any individual study can show either it's good for you or it's bad for you. That's the confusing part about science. It depends on how you ask the question or where you're asking the question in this case. But what the consensus is of these people who don't just look at Antarctic sea ice or flooding or fires or what have you in a particular year or a particular set of years, but they look at the global picture, and the global picture is completely clear. So I take your point that it's not that there's no conflicting evidence about climate change. It's just that the broad picture isn't unclear to people. And they will not. I mean, no one can say. I mean, there was this famous day when it snowed in in Washington and somebody brought a snowball to the floor of the Senate and said, look, how could there be global warming if we got a snowball in Washington, D.C.? Well, I've had lots of snow in Washington, D.C. It's the individual. And it's hard because because I've done this, you know, there was another really politically controversial topic about embryonic stem cells. And so I covered a lot of stuff about embryonic stem cells, which, of course, were controversial because they're derived from embryos. Okay, I get that. I'm not. But people said, why aren't you focusing on adult stem cells? They also have remarkable properties. And I said, because adult stem cells have been around for 20 or 30 or 40 years, and embryonic stem cells are new. And that's kind of the journalism world. We talk about what's new, not always correctly and not always in the right balance, but that's the nature of the beast.
We had a few callers who couldn't stay with us, Joe Palka. Rebecca from Monroe wanted to share that she's 61 and amazed how the number of satellites have grown in our night sky. Shane from Wausau wanted to know more about psilocybin and its potential to help with depression, psilocybin. And
psilocybin.
And Delilah from Whitewater called to ask how you cover such a broad field of so many topics.
Yes, total chutzpah, that's all it is. The answer about the psilocybin question, that was very interesting. NPR just did a story about how that might have some value in treating intractable depression. It is amazing the things that have – I mean, ketamine was another one. That was supposed to be a party drug, and all of a sudden it turns out to be useful for treating depression. So that's interesting. How I cover all sorts of things, I think I'm actually going to – say, I take a lot of heart from Alan Alda's work. Do you know him?
Alan, uh-huh.
So he's done a lot of science and science communication mm-hmm. work in the last few decades. And he talked about going into a story with the same knowledge as somebody who didn't know anything about it. And in a way, that's like lazy because you can say, well, you could learn a little and then you wouldn't be such an idiot when you do the interviews. But that's not his point. I think his point, and I think it's a really good one, is – if you go in with knowledge, you're going to ask the smarty pants questions instead of the, what is, you know, the everyman's questions, every person's
every
questions.
Every person's, yeah.
And so I don't know, I mean, like, I don't know anything about math. I don't know anything about the electric dipole moment of the neutron, if we get to that. I don't know about a lot of these things, but I go in with the same curiosity that somebody who's never heard about them goes in with, and I ask. And that's how I learn about all these things, I ask.
NPR science correspondent Joe Palka is with us for the hour as we explore his storytelling and the world of science. Still time for your questions, your thoughts, and what science stories stick with you. Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a moment, more conversation here with Joe Palka on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about science journalism this hour. The NSF, the National Science Foundation, receives approximately 40,000 proposals each year for research, of which 11,000 are funded. Stiff competition. Science journalists, they're covering developments from funded research. What do you want to know about how NPR science correspondent Joe Palka covers his big ideas? Join in 800-642-1234, and Joe Palka stays with us. So, Joe, we cover science here on The Morning Show quite regularly, and I want to give a shout-out to our listeners. Yesterday, we were talking about a bubble barrier, about this disco barrier that's going up at a dam in Kentucky, or it's activated there, to prevent Asian carp from invading waterways, specifically the Great Lakes, that they're really worried about. And the scientist leading the project, Teresa Lewis, she's based in Onalaska, Wisconsin. And near the end of our conversation, like 3 minutes to go, there's this brilliant question that came in from Kevin in Janesville.
Is there a concern that long-term exposure to these sound bubbles, et cetera, the fish will be accustomed and the system will no longer be effective?
Well, that's a really great question, and we call that process of becoming accustomed to the sound habituation.
So that's Teresa Lewis, the scientist. Several things going on here, but I want to focus on the scientist explaining the word habituation. How do scientists and science reporters deal with jargon?
Well, luckily, habituation is one of the few I do know because it's a term out of psychology, I guess it's used in physiological sciences too. You pick up a metaphor, you pick up you come up with an analogy that's based on something that people are more familiar with. And so I guess the example might be in the hotel room I have, there's this refrigerator that's making a funny gurgling sound. And at first it was driving me nuts, and then I sort of stopped hearing it. And that's a phenomenon I think everybody can relate to, that the sounds that they're familiar with, or smells is another one. You go into a room and it smells bad, and then after a while you don't notice. And you go out and you come back in and it smells bad again. It's not like the room stopped smelling bad when you were in it. It just you became accommodated to it, or you habituated to it. So I think that's a term that people can understand. There are some that are much harder, but lateral inhibition, I'm not going to explain that one.
Yeah, how do you, when you're in an interview and your scientist is getting really deep into the weeds with terminology, do you steer them out, or how do you make the words accessible? The concepts accessible.
Susan Stamberg explained this to me when I first got to NPR, and I think it's the way you should do it is, I try not to tell the scientists what to say. If they are completely incapable of saying something in normal language, I'll say, ask them a question like, what's your favorite color? And if they can throw jargon into that answer, they're good. But her point, Susan's point to me was, look, you're the communicator. Make sure you understand what they're talking about, and then you do the hard parts and let them do the easier parts, like what's your favorite color, what you had for breakfast. It's amazing. If you go and listen to a lot of the tape I play, it doesn't talk about the science. It talks about things like the scientists will say, oh, and then we didn't know what to do. They become transitional as opposed to factual. Mm-hmm. Some scientists are fantastic. They say habituate. Oh, well, that means, you hear something over and over again and you become accustomed to it and you stop responding to it. Okay, you've explained habituation. If they don't do that, if they can't do that, I have been known. There was a time when somebody was using a lot of jargon. I said, you've got to stop because I don't understand what you're talking about. And she started up again and she used some word and I went, I'm sorry, you cannot use that word. I just took a chance. Some people be totally put off by that. Maybe she was. I don't know. But she laughed and said, oh, I get it. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm so used to talking. I get it. It's hard. But I'm the one that's what I do for a living. And so I should be helping them. Feel comfortable. I just don't like when you tell people not to use jargon, they wind up talking baby talk at you sometimes, mm-hmm. and it doesn't feel like they're really being honest. And I prefer honesty to clarity, and I'll take care of the clarity and you take care of the honesty.
In our last seconds together, you have the series Joe's Big Idea, and I always wonder, how do you know it's a big idea? So many things cross your desk. When do you just go, oh, aha, that's it?
It is so haphazard as to make you cry. As I said, when you were asking about George Brezeni, I was at a memorial service. We didn't get to talk about my favorite electric dipole moment of the neutron, but it's the same initials as EDM, electric dance music. I thought, well, that's hilarious. I can put that in the intro, and people will say, he didn't even know the difference. I'm trying to make it something that's accessible and interesting. After that, it's catch as catch can.
Joe, thank you for joining us.
Sure.
Joe Palca has been a science correspondent for NPR since 1992. He is the host of the series Joe's Big Idea. He's here in Madison for the annual meeting and student research conference of the Scientific Research Honor Society, Sigma Xi. Tonight, the women's wrestling team at the UW-Stevens Point will host their first ever match at home. Most colleges don't offer women's programs, but Rob Mensah reports that's changing as more and more girls and women get involved.
Jessica Rodier was 4 years old when she started wrestling.
I wanted to be like my big brother, so I wanted to do what he did.
She started competing in youth leagues in the Green Bay area. There wasn't a girls' wrestling program at her school, so she wrestled with the boys.
I wouldn't say it wasn't hard for me because that's the way I grew up. So to me that was acceptable. None of the guys that I wrestled had any problems with it. I didn't have any problems with it.
She was also really, really good at it. Wrestling is a sport, but it's also a discipline. Rodier said it's a constant grind. It's physically intense, of course, but it requires an equally intense mental and even emotional focus. Rodier loved it, though there were times when her male opponents couldn't handle losing to a girl.
Some would actually, like, go cry and then try to quit and stuff like that, or, like, their teammates would pick on them forever.
Rodier would go on to win a national championship in college. Today, she's an assistant coach at the brand new women's wrestling program at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. It's the first women's wrestling program at a public university in the Midwest, but it won't be the last. Women's wrestling is booming.
Keep going.
On a Tuesday afternoon in October, Stevens Point's women's wrestling team is practicing ahead of their first meet. Members of the team pair up and practice takedowns. Brooke Thurber has been wrestling for 18 years. She's 21. Her dad coaches wrestling at Nakusa High School, so she grew up with the sport.
It, like, challenges me in so many different ways, and it's just so fun, and I love the team atmosphere and just being pushed so hard.
Are you one of the best?
Maybe not the best, but I always push myself to try to be the best, yeah.
Johnny Johnson has been the men's wrestling coach at UW-Stevens Point for more than 20 years. He says he looks at wrestling like a physical chess game, requiring you to anticipate your opponent's moves. He has a crew cut and an easy rapport with Rodier, who shows off her socks in his office.
They're cow socks!
You have some serious issues.
Daddy, you can't even go wrong with these! Look at them!
You can't go right with them.
Yeah, you can!
It was several years ago that Johnson and others on his coaching staff made a push to add women's wrestling.
Every time we would see an article or something that would indicate that women's wrestling is growing pretty much exponentially, that we would send that to our athletic director.
According to a national coaches group, as of 1994, there were about 800 high school girls across the country competing in wrestling. By 2018, there were closer to 17,000. There are more than 63 colleges with varsity women's wrestling programs, and that number is exploding too.
Between the time we announced last year and now, there's been about 26 schools, I want to say, that have announced that they are also adding women's wrestling on the collegiate level.
After the day's practice, first-year student Abby Nelson says she's a little nervous about the October 26th meet against Michigan's Adrian College.
I know it's my first competition. I've never competed before in, like, a college sport, so it'll be new to me still.
As it turned out, Nelson would notch the first win in the program's history, and she'd face her teammate Brooke Thurber in the finals for their weight class. Thurber won it. They both say wrestling is a passion. Nelson is glad to be able to compete on a women's team.
Yeah, it's hard to be a woman in a man's sport, they say, but, like, now it's turning into almost a woman's sport as well.
Thurber agrees things have changed since she was younger.
I think there was such a stigma back then that girls shouldn't be in a boy's sport because it's so aggressive. But girls can be just as aggressive and just as technical as boys, and they can work just as hard, so.
In January, the NCAA will vote on whether to make women's wrestling one of its official emerging sports for women. Rob Menser, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The public hearings of the House impeachment inquiry into President Trump continue this morning. We're carrying live coverage on WPR on our NPR News and Classical Music Network. You can also listen online at WPR.org. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.